Welcome back to the Babylon Podcast. I am Tim Callender.
And I am Summer Brooks.
And tonight we are honored to be graced with the presence of Ambassador Delenn herself, Mira Furlan.
All right.
Welcome to the show, Mira. We're happy to have you.
We're delighted.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm here. All right.
So I have many questions, and right. I'd actually like to start at the beginning. What was it that drew you to acting in the first place?
Oh, my God. It was actually an interesting thing that happened to me and with me and in me. In high school, I went to a language-oriented high school, which was popularly called the English high school. And so we had extra classes of English, which came handy when I emigrated to America. But one of the things that happened is that an English teacher, an English professor, who just a very young guy, vibrant, incredible, super educated, super fun, very musical, and so on and so forth, came just after finishing his studies at Oxford, came to teach at our school and at the University of Zagreb. And he decided to do a play with us. And so we did a play in English. We rehearsed for a whole year on weekends when other kids were playing soccer and basketball and so on. We were rehearsing this play. And we then did it, and it opened, and it was a big success. But it's a high school play. But what happened is at that opening night, right, I had a true epiphany. And somehow, I realized that this is what I want to do, which is kind of crazy because you don't make those decisions about the future of your life, in an epiphany on the stage of a high school auditorium when you're 17 years old. But that's what happened. And then, it was I never really explored that, never thought about that. But something happened on that stage. In that moment, my character was opening the play. The play was by an English writer, John Arden. It was called Live Like Pigs. And of course, we all loved it because it was about an abandoned, kind of ruined, a little tiny town in England where the industry went away and people were unemployed and it was full of old people who drank a lot and smoked a lot. It was the world that excited us because we felt like we were in a movie. We were playing this Humphrey Bogart characters and we were so seasoned and experienced and it was just very exciting. And it changed my life. And then I I was not sure. And I enrolled into the university in English and French. English is my major, French is my minor. But secretly, I went to audition at the Academy of Dramatic Arts and thought, if they don't, accept me, who cares? I have my other plans. They did. And I always thought I would have a way out of it, if I wanted, but life is much more complicated than that. And it became, I got hooked. And also, when I started to be immersed into the work of an actor, I started loving it and discovering it and so on and so forth. And I started working on my second year of studies and my work exploded and I did so much in such a short period of time in my 20s. It was kind of crazy. Not easy actually, because it kind of came to me very, very, really, truly like an explosion, right. And it was hard to control it. And it was hard, I became, sort of famous very quickly. And it was hard to deal with it. So it wasn't this super happy experience, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a complex experience with handling the whole thing at such a young age. But and then, you know, life got even more complicated after that. But yes, that's, if you ask me about the very beginning of it, it was truly one moment, you know, when I was standing on that stage in the opening moments of this play, you know, and smoking a cigarette on stage. That kind of changed my life.
Wow.
Yeah, very weird.
So when you emigrated to the United States, without going into the political unrest that was happening in your home country at the time, did you emigrate with the notion that you would make it as an actress in the United States, or were you emigrating just simply to make a move?
It was more of the latter. You know, we didn't have, I mean, the desperate, horrible situation in our country where I somehow suddenly became a controversial figure, you know, because I was working all over that country, which was falling apart, right? And each mm-hmm. of those new countries wanted to show that life together was impossible, right? And should be prevented at all costs. And in a way, you know, I became a symbol of that possibility of living together, you know, these all diverse people of Yugoslavia who were able to live together. So that notion, I mean, it was a, you know, it was a nationalistic war. The idea of so-called ethnic purity, you know, and you know, which was so opposed to everything I believe in my life.
Right.
And these ideas won in the former Yugoslavia, and my husband and I decided that we didn't want to participate in this new world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where ethnicity and your belonging to a certain tribe became the most relevant factor in your whole life, right? And of course, you know, what was more different than that? What was the country that had, you know, that was built on the idea of diversity? It was America. So that's what brought us to America. So you can imagine how I feel right now when in America there are all these other these ideas that we know from our past. Right, that are being promoted all over the place. So.
Yeah, and it's interesting because just to flash forward a bit, you know, I remember some of the storylines in Babylon 5 with the Night Watch and some right. of that thing. And I remember watching this in the mid to late 90s, going, well, you know, this is a really fascinating story, but thank God we don't have to worry about that. And now I go back and watch it, and it's like it's almost prophetic. I'm like, oh, no.
I know. It's true. Joe Straczynski, I mean, I love the political aspect of Babylon 5 because he really talked about all these issues, right? And he, you know, we talked a lot, Joe and I, at the time. And I gave him a piece that I wrote, an open letter that I wrote in those years, kind of claiming my little political manifesto, you know, where I said I cannot and I refuse to hate those who stayed on the other side of this new wall, right? Wall mm-hmm. of hatred, right? And separation and so on. And he used a lot of my experience in the show, which was really amazing how he kind of, you know, elegantly used it, right? But yes, you know, the thing is, you know, when we first came here and people were kind of interested in our story and everybody would ask, so what is happening? As soon as we started explaining what was happening, I would see that their focus is shifting and, you know, and it was just so hard to understand and so on and so forth. And people would always say, it's so foreign to us. We just don't get it. We just don't have that in our country. Mm-hmm. And so now I have to say, you know, and at that time, I thought, wait, you can't say that. You have all of it in your country, as we all have. All humanity has it in you know, I mean, there are all these things underneath the surface, you know, that we don't want to know, or we don't want to be aware of them, and we just, you know, bury them under the carpet. But they have a tendency to come out. And I was aware of that even then. But now, you know, people know very, very well what's happening, right? And then, so there is, you know, there is a good aspect in all that, I think, you know, that people got much more aware. I mean, if you want, politically aware or socially aware of what's happening, they have to be. You know, there's this, you know, you can't stay outside of it anymore, right? And pretend that you don't understand and that it's not your problem, because it is your problem. It's all of our problem, right? I mean, all of us. So that's kind of, yes. So, you know, there's a little bit of déjà vu in everything, but on a much more dangerous scale, I would say, right? Because we were very, you know, that it was a small country. I mean, it didn't have the power to influence the whole world or to change the whole world. I mean, you know, so now we live in a different world. The whole world changed. It's not about America only. It's about the whole global movement, right, that I see in the whole world. And so it's a very, very strange and dangerous moment, I think. Yeah. And to wrap it up and bring it back to Babylon 5, I mean, all these elements were in the show. I mean, it's really amazing, right?
So to that point, I'm curious now, listening to what you've told us, how much of that was already present in the plan for the show, the arc for the show when you got there, and how much of it do you think developed as you had these conversations with Joe?
I mean, you know, that's something that you would have to ask Joe Straczynski. I mean, I don't know how much all these conversations and, you know, things that were happening at that time, not only conversations with me, but also, you know, I mean, if you remember, I mean, a war, the siege, the, you know, the question whether the world, the West, should intervene or not, finally, you know, the bombing and blah, 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 and all of this, you know, so there was, I mean, it was in the news all the time. Which was horrible, you know, and which created this feeling that you can never get away, you know,
right?
Even you can never get away from it, and you can't. It stays with you, right? All of it. I couldn't really tell you how much of it was planned ahead of time. A lot of it was planned, but. But, you know, the very idea of this character, of Delenn, that had the need and kind of felt the obligation of changing her whole being, her physical being, in order to be a bridge between the warring nations, that was so, you know, close to what I tried to do, but failed, of course, because, you know, the odds were so huge and the stakes were so high, and I was just one person, and the forces, you know, that were at play were incredibly, you know, the propaganda, the war propaganda is a powerful tool. Every authoritarian government knows that. So that's a little bit of that story.
Right.
Do you think that some of the storylines working through that, acting through what Joe was writing, helped you have a little bit of hope? Because we saw people like, you know, Delenn leading the charge, not wanting to give up, not wanting to give in to the darkness. And watching the show now, seeing that people are still willing to fight for what is right for what their hearts tell them is the right path, you know, that science fiction giving me hope is probably the best thing right now. And I wanted to know, did you see some of that in what you guys were filming?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Sure. I mean, look, I mean, hope also came in a different way to me, you know, because I found, I mean, I was, it was a stroke of luck, you know. I found my tribe. I found my family on Babylon 5, right? After leaving everything behind, my life, my career, my status, my home, my friends, my dad, I mean, everything, you know, you lose everything. And you have no idea if you're ever going to find another home or something close to home, right? And I did, and you know, so I'm talking not about the storylines and what we filmed, but just the fact that I filmed, you know, that I could connect with what I thought then was my so-called identity, you know, all these terms, you know, are questionable from this perspective now. But at that moment, that was crucial for me. It was life-saving to be on the set again, you know, and to be able to get back, I mean, to connect with who you were, who you are, right? In a different language, in a different culture, in a different land. But I knew these people. I remember that first day on the pilot. I mean, I was freaking out. I was incredibly scared that I won't understand what I'm told, that I'm going to make a mistake, that I'm going to, you know, I mean, John Flynn, the cinematographer, he had a, you know, this cowboy kind of attitude, and he didn't articulate his consonants and vowels, and I oh my God, it was such a struggle to understand. And you know, they would give me instructions and I wouldn't quite understand. I mean, that's, you know, being an immigrant, it's really, really hard, because you feel like you're always behind. You don't, you know, Jerry Doyle with his quick mind, these jokes that were flying around, and I couldn't catch them. I was trying to catch them and be on top of things. And you feel like you're a little bit, you know, mentally challenged or a child, you know, a child. So it was a struggle. But at the same time, it was incredible. I knew those people. I knew the gaffer. I knew the dolly, you know, puller, the focus puller, the dolly guy. I mean, I you know, I was at home on a film set, and that was brilliant. You know, they were completely different and they spoke a different language, but I knew them. They were my people, and that feeling was incredibly comforting. And as I said, life saving, truly life saving.
How did you get the role of Delenn in the first place?
You know, I mean, again, a stroke of luck, you know, randomness. I mean, I absolute randomness, I think. It was one of my first auditions. An actor who, you know, somebody recommended him to me, sent me to his agent, and the agent said, okay, let's try. We're not going to sign anything, but let's try. I'll send you to a couple of auditions, and it was one of the first auditions that I did in New York. We were living in New York at that time, and then nothing happened, and I completely forgot about it. And then I happened to be in Los Angeles for just 3 days. My agent called me and said, you know, since you're already there, they want to see you again. I came to Los Angeles because my husband's movie was screening in DGA, and I mean I had no business being there, but I wanted to see it. And so I happened to be there, and that's when I had my second edition, and then they wanted to, and then they called again and said, can she stay a little bit longer? Yes, I could stay a little bit longer, and I had my third audition, and that's when I got it. I mean, it was crazy. Well, now it seems crazy because, you know, I realize how hard it is to get a lead on a TV series. At that time, you know, it just happened so quickly after I landed on these shores. And, you know, that you start thinking, oh, that's how it goes. That's going to be my life, you know.
Right.
And then it doesn't really develop that way.
Right.
But it was interesting. It was interesting. It was an interesting timing, and that happens so rarely, you know. It was really the thing that we needed at that time, you know. And it really changed my life in so many ways. It gave me the feeling that I could continue my life, you know, that I could be an actor again, that I have a future, you know, because all these things were really questionable at that time. You know, it was a very, very depressing time for us and very hard.
Mm-hmm. It was like I like to remind people that Delenn was probably one of the first modern sci-fi badasses on TV, because Delenn predated Xena and Buffy. And
right.
I by like what 3 or 4 years at least. And mm-hmm. just to point out that she had a quiet strength, a determination, a purpose that was unshakable.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So she didn't get in there and fight with a sword or a PPG or anything, but she had her own way of inspiring other people to rise up and be their best. And then that led us to Xena and Buffy and all sorts of other cool warrior women. So that is...
It's true. And you know, I loved in that character that she was not like this you know, man in female clothes. She had the gentleness, the sweetness, even the sensitivity, the vulnerability, you know. She had all that, but at the same time she was incredibly strong and knew when to be forceful and use her strength and power, you know, right? So it was this complex character. I mean, that's what was so lovely playing that character.
I think one of my favorite moments, and it's a very little moment, it's the first date that Captain Sheridan and Delenn share early on the second season, where Delenn invites Sheridan out for dinner to talk about mm-hmm. anything except treaties and who's doing what to whom. And
right. They
basically shut the restaurant down. And there's that moment where she says, who knew we had so much in common? And Sheridan says, yeah. And then both look away with this. It was such a real thing. And you knew at that moment that those two characters were destined to be together, but it never, that relationship never felt forced or false. So it was so
right.
real, and it was so believable. And so what was it like to develop that relationship with Bruce Boxleitner?
Well, Bruce is a very, very, you know, honest and giving actor, and it was just so easy to work with him. Such a pleasure. Super professional, super kind and nice, and I was very lucky in that respect, because you know, for me it's all about the other actor and in this exchange with other actors. That's the greatest pleasure that I get from this profession, right? And sometimes you work with people with nothing happens, you feel that nothing happens, and with Bruce you know, everything happened all the time, so to say, you know, because he was there, he was present, it was a great relationship. You know, it really, you know, you can't explain it. It's just, with some people it's there, with some people it's just not there, whatever you do. You know, the other beautiful actor that I almost never worked with on the show, but I had the pleasure of doing this one scene that was really, I mean, you know, it's stuck in my mind forever, and it will be. That's Andreas Katsoulas. Mm-hmm. And we had a scene that, to me, when I read it, it seemed, yeah, just so, one of those scenes with a lot of dialogue, you know, and, you know, I learned my lines. And I didn't think, you know, there was no apparent emotional power to that scene, right? It was an intellectual, when I read it, it seemed to me like an intellectual discussion, theoretical, you know, discussion about, I mean, maybe you'll remember the scene, whether it's, you know, justified to kill a million people in order to save,
oh, yeah,
I don't know, 100 million people, you remember? And mm-hmm. to me, it seemed like such a, this argument. And okay, let's just get over with it and let's do it. And I came to the set, and as soon as we began doing the scene, Andreas completely, I mean, you know, there were tears in his eyes. There was this deep emotional layer that he gave to this intellectual discussion. And suddenly it became about very survival. I mean, this moral question became he filled the intellectual content of that scene with such emotional strength and depth that it lifted me up, and suddenly I was there too. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I really, truly, I thought at this moment, this is what a phenomenal actor does for the other actor, for his partner. In a way, you don't have to do anything. You just have to kind of surrender to this other person who lifts you up, you know, and who changes you forever. I mean, you know, and you become bigger and better and more layered and mm-hmm. more complex just by opening yourself up to him or her. And so that's the beauty. That's the beauty in that profession. You know, there are so many lows in this profession, but that's one of the greatest gifts that you can be given. You know, suddenly the you know, he discovered all these other elements in this scene, which I couldn't see, you know, mm-hmm. by myself. So that you know, those are the magical moments that you live for, right?
I think that scene is probably one of my favorite Jakar scenes because he brings everybody to tears. Because the last line he says is, "I may, like, someday I may forgive you, but not today."
But not today, yes.
And it's like that just makes you just shivers. It's like, whoa.
Right. Right, and I remember the tears in your eyes, Mira, as the scene was unfolding. It was just, it was so real and so.
I know. It all happened complete. You know, it's you can't plan these things. That they really have to happen on the spot, just by, you know, but you have to have two people who are open. You know, who are open to each other and to whatever is happening, right? You have to be able to go there, and that's probably, you know, that's it. That's that's what it makes it all worthwhile, you know.
Right.
All those bad aspects in. But yes, that was one of those moments, and I'm so glad that it you know it shines through you. you also saw it, you know, not that only we felt it, but it came through, it was on the screen,
mm-hmm.
and it will stay there. And that's lovely, that's beautiful. Yes, I mean, we had an extraordinary cast. Really,
to that point, I'm sorry, I was going to say, one of the strengths of Babylon 5 that I think makes it endure is that the show is full of those moments of honesty with the characters, you know, that it elevates it beyond just the plot of mysterious bad guy aliens coming in to fight the good guys, that it very much becomes a personal story.
Yeah, true. Yeah. And you know, a human story. Yes, we all had makeup, and you know, I can't say I was happy with that, and that's a whole other discussion, you know. but through all that, and I mean, I learned so much from Andreas. I mean, you know, who always told me whenever I was unhappy, and he would always tell me, I mean, just remember, you know, all acting began with masks. I mean, you know, he's Greek. He was of Greek origin, and he always reminded me. And I played a lot of Greek tragedies in my life, like Antigone and Medea. And, you know, I love them, and I feel them, and Helen, another Euripides, and so on. And he always reminded me, you know, just remember, all acting began with masks. You know, so try to find freedom in this lack of freedom, right?
Mm-hmm.
In this frame, you know, the reduction. Try to find freedom in the reduction of the means of expression that you have on your disposal. And he was a master of that, absolute master. I mean, that's, you know, that I've never really worked with an actor who had so much freedom, took so much freedom. You know, he could do anything at any moment. I mean, it was a masterclass in acting, really. We were all blessed with his presence, I think. Yeah.
That leads me to a question I've always wondered about. And you've touched on some of it here in our conversation, but you know, you are an actor who's come to a new country, and you're looking to establish yourself. And the first role you get, not only are you in a mask, but the original idea was to completely make Delenn genderless, so that the reveal of her being a human, but then also a female, would have been more shocking. What were your thoughts around that when you got the role and they said, guess what, we're going to completely hide you?
I mean, you know, I was, you know, you have to be able to get rid of your vanity, first of all, you know, of your ego, of everything you think you are. You know, it's really, I mean, it's the act of emigrating as in itself. And then the thing that happened to me on Babylon 5, on this pilot, where I was actually, you know, suddenly I didn't have my face, which was my main means of production,
right?
My tool, you know what I mean? It's me. And the other thing, not only it is my tool, but it's also who I am. It's connected to the core of who I am. So you have to somehow be able, that was really hard. Not to even mention, you know, the whole vanity thing, which is such a big part of being an actor, and especially of and also being an actress, and a female actor, where so much is about your looks and the whole, you know, appeal and blah blah blah, all those questionable things, right? The sexist idea of an actress, right, which was so present in the way I was treated in the Balkans, which is a very macho country and incredibly patriarchal and so on and so forth. So it was really incredibly challenging for me to get rid of all those layers, you know, and search for another way of being an actor. I've never done anything like this before, never in my life. Very challenging on many, many fronts. But you know, I can't say, you know, it was such a mixed experience for me. So yes, you get a job, but guess what? You know, you're covered with makeup from head to toe.
Right.
You know, first of all, it was not, I mean, in a way, it didn't do wonders for my career, right? Because it was as if I was working incognito. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. incognito. I mean, nobody cared. I mean, I did 2 seasons of Babylon 5. I went to find a better agent, and you know, the agents would say, "What? You have makeup on? Okay, go away. We don't want you." It was all the time. Listen, it was the time when science fiction was not a part of the mainstream.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, Babylon 5 was, in many respects, ahead of its time. I see that now. You know, now you have, oh my God. Where the names. I mean, what do you not have? Science fiction is so mainstream that it's crazy, right? But in those days, it was genre, right? It was a little bit frowned upon. We really were second class citizens, you know, in terms of the industry establishment, mm-hmm. and I felt. Every time. I felt it all the time, right? It just didn't matter what you did underneath the mask. It didn't matter. It was not recognizable as you know, I'm putting it under quotation marks, a real acting. Mm-hmm. So it was a double-edged sword in so many things. It was a very complex experience. For me, as you can see, I have to say, you know, when we were doing the pilot, and they tried to put, and they did, they put black lenses into my eyes. I said, I can't do that. That created such a feeling of claustrophobia and panic. I had a true panic attack, and I said, I can't do this. And if they had, you know, I think of it a lot. If they had said, okay, then we'll use somebody else, you know, my life would have been different and Babylon 5 would have been different. Mm-hmm. You know, you just think of these moments that make your life and think, you know, they could have been completely different and my life would have been different. But there is a you know, limit to what can be done, you know, to you as an actor. It's you know, yes, there is a limit. I mean, you know, there was once. I don't remember the episode. You will probably know what I'm talking about. But there is this new race. You remember? I talked to a little girl,
yes.
Who I kept saving. Right. So that race, they created that race. In such a way, the makeup people, that the actors who were underneath that makeup couldn't breathe through their noses.
Oh, no.
Yes.
They didn't have the noses. And that made me think, this is not right. This cannot, I mean, you know, even actors have basic human rights. And one of those basic human rights should be that you should be able to breathe through your nose.
Right.
And I literally remember thinking that, you know, there should be something against. And there was an old old man, an old actor who came. I mean, he was 70, 75, I don't know. He was struggling to breathe. And I thought, this, you know, I wanted to scream. But, you know, that's how it was.
We
went through all that stuff.
We talked to Marshall Teague, and he talked about his first time on the show in the episode Infection, where he plays this man who's transformed into an alien war machine, and he said it was a head-to-toe bodysuit, and yeah. they ended up having to drill holes in the bottom of the boots so all his perspiration, which was pooling in his feet,
oh
could drain out.
Oh, my God. I know. It's like you go through a surgery, you know? It's not. I mean, acting shouldn't be that, you know? You should suffer so much. Oh, my God.
So go through the first Minbari makeup where Delenn was bald with the bone crest, or the transformation half Minbari, half human with the hair and the bone crest?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the makeup in the pilot, it made me very miserable. But... But, you know, in the end, I'm very glad I used it. so it you know, it's good to be comfortable. I mean, I sound spoiled, but, you know, it's good to be able to breathe and for your skin to breathe. And it's just this restriction. I mean, but, okay, I'm saying all these things. And then I think of Andreas, who embraced it, you know. He, you know, he always said, "I love it." you know, and that's the way to do it, actually, you know, because everything has its. I mean, you have to be able to feel good in whatever they put on you, and you know, I mean, in Yugoslav films, I was always, you know, in a tiny little piece of clothing in the middle of winter, or in heavy woolen coats in the middle of summer. I mean, you know, it's not much different with makeup. It's always, you have to be able to get through the difficulty somehow. That's the challenge. You know, it seems easy, but it's not easy. It's not easy. It's a mental, you need to have a mental preparation and somehow be able to deal with all that stuff. It's never very comfortable, I mean, or at least not in my experience.
I have a question.
Yes.
Because it's one of the funniest sequences in the entire series, and it never ceases to make me smile. It's right after, shortly after Delenn transforms from Minbari to half Minbari, half human, and she asks Susan Ivanova for help with what to do with this hair.
Right. It's funny. It's funny. I mean, you know, when I read that scene, I have to say, I was appalled. Like, that's so not Delenn, you know? Mm-hmm. And I went to Zilla Straczynski and said, I can't imagine that. It's a completely different genre, so to say, you know, for my character. I mean, this comedic, you know, thing. And he said, just do it. I'll never forget that. I mean, no, you know, he didn't even want to explain. And I tried, and it worked. And that's it, you know? So you never, I mean, actors are always so possessive with their characters. And I become that too, you know? I mean, you know that. It's like a cliche when actors said, but she would never do that. She would never say that. But, you know, you have to expand, and you have to be able to imagine all kinds of unimaginable things. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. But in this case, it kind of opened it up, you know, this super serious character. Suddenly we see her in another way, and it's fun. It's just pure fun. Yeah, I agree.
Were there any other just silly moments that you remember that you had with different cast members that that just that make you happy?
Make me happy.
Or just make you
I
laugh.
I don't know. Right. God. You know, just seeing Andreas and Peter act always make me, you know, together. that was always hilarious and beautiful. And I just remember them together. And you know, from time to time, I saw them at conventions doing their little thing together. Very, very cute. And yes, I miss Andreas and I miss Rick Biggs, who, that's a whole other story, you know, what a beautiful, wonderful man he was. Yeah, we had a lot of losses.
Mm-hmm.
See how I veered from your question about funny moments to the most tragic aspect of it. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
No, that's okay. That's all
but,
right.
But, you know, yes, it's weird. I mean, you know, how we life actually split us in half. You know, half of our cast members are no longer with us alive. So that's very sad. Very, very sad and kind of strange. But that's it. And time passes so quickly. Oh my God. I mean, okay, stop me before I you know, go into the
No, keep going.
Misery. Yes, so it was, what can I say? It was a good time. A good part of my life, nice part.
Good, and you should know just from your time going to the conventions how much your character, your portrayal of that character means to the fans, even now.
Yeah, that's very nice. I mean, I was just recently I was in Germany, and at that big convention called FedCon.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really surprised at how, you know, very young people are coming to these conventions and telling me all those wonderful things about their experience with Babylon 5, because they were second, you know, they're the second generation of audience. It's so weird discovering it for themselves, the next generation. Yeah, that's very, very valuable. Yes, I mean, I never knew that I would, you know, it's just I fell into it, and it's lasting to this day. It's really, really, truly amazing what an impact it made on the people. Yeah.
Well, great stories are timeless stories, and Babylon 5 really captured, I think, the heart and spirit of what it means to be human, as much as there were quote unquote not human characters on the show. Hmm. But
that's
it was
interesting.
It was, you know, it was tragic and it was funny and it was uplifting, and it explored, you know, where we lose our humanity and also what we need to do to reclaim it. And I go back to it, and the things that moved me then move me now, and I take great heart from it. And I think about the scene with John and Delenn in the in War Without End, where you're flashing between the future and the present, and Sheridan asked Delenn, you know, did we win the war? And Delenn says, this fight never ends. But everything we set out to do, we achieved. And to me, that's a great touch point, as we talked about earlier in this particular point of history in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. I think that's something to remember and something to strive for, you know?
Right. No fight is ever won. That is so true. I mean, you really, truly understand. Deeply understand it now. It's just a continual fight for humanity, for just to be truly human, right?
Yeah.
It never, because the challenges are always, always there, you know. And you think, I mean, it's I've lived with this illusion that some values that America has achieved, you know, this whole idea of America being the city on the hill, you know, that whole idea, you know, the ideal for all the rest of us and so on and so forth, that some values cannot be lost, but they can.
Yes.
They can everywhere and in any time. So, you know, we have to be vigilant all the time, and there's no giving up. I mean, easier said than done, because the world becomes at times so depressing, and you just cannot believe that these values that you thought were so crucial to the identity of a world, you know, can be lost, and that, you know, the whole world plunges into something that we should remember, you know, from our history. Mm-hmm. It's a great thought by Oscar Wilde. You know, that there's only one thing that we learn from history, that we don't learn anything from history.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's it. We just don't. And it's a continuous circle that we human beings, I mean, really like hamsters. We're just like hamsters. You know? I mean, really depressing thoughts. But yes, Babylon 5 dealt with all those issues and discussed all those issues and was on the right side, which makes me very happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are you up to these days? If B5 fans wanted to catch you in something that you're working on now, where would they look?
You know, I'm trying to write an autobiographical book, and I've been dealing with it for many years, on and off. It's been on my mind, so to say, for, I don't know, last maybe 10 years, which is a horribly depressing thing to say, but I still have to, the book is done, it has to be, I mean, it's a, you know, my life is long and the book is very long, and I have to find a way to presented and to find people who would be able to bring it into the world, and I haven't been able to do that, but I hope, you know, my hope is that I will do that, because I think my stories are relevant for today's moment in America and the world, you know, because I feel like I've lived through it already, you know, and now it's happening in a small environment, so to say, and now this is a global story, so there is something that I want to say, you know, almost as a warning, you know. So that's what I've been, that's my main focus these days. And it's been a challenging thing to find the right words and to find the right way to tell that story. But that's what I'm trying to do. You know, apart from that, I'm in my regular daily life, I occasionally do acting jobs. Some of them are in my old country. I mean, I did a couple of movies that were interesting in these last years. I did an interesting voiceover just now, a month ago, on a really interesting video game that surprised me, because it's completely nonviolent and it's about the exploration of the ocean and so on and so forth. It's called Beyond Blue. I really kind of loved it and was surprised that these things exist, you know, in that world.
Uh-huh.
What else? I'm occasionally teaching. I'm teaching right now at New York Film Academy, and I'm teaching all kinds of subjects, and it's a pleasure for me to be surrounded by young people from all over the world, and I'm teaching at the Liberal Arts and Science Department, so I'm expanding my experience and knowledge and learning new stuff and teaching literature and teaching art, culture, and society, crazy subjects like that. And, you know, it's all about discussing the issues of today. And that all interests me, you know. I'm kind of tapping into my intellectual side, under quotation marks. And so, you know, I was always very, very interested in different things. I want to, you know, writing is something that really, really interests me. And I wrote a play that is now in its fourth year in Belgrade, in Serbia, which is a country that came out of ex-Yugoslavia after the war. And it's an autobiographical play that is very successful there, you know. So I've been doing different things in my life, and I like doing different things. That's it. I don't know, just living, you know, living, and trying to be a parent and trying to be a human being, you know. That's the main job, I think.
Yeah. Would you entertain writing for the stage in New York?
Well, you know, the play that I wrote could be done here, although it's very, very specific to the time and place, you know, which is the 70s, socialist Yugoslavia in the 70s, and my growing up and my parents and so on and so forth. But it's... Yeah, it could be done here. I haven't really, I translated it, I haven't really found a way to make money as writing. You know, I don't know how to do that. I have no idea about that world. So that's a whole other world that needs to be explored. You know, and I'm asking myself, do I have time for that? Right. Time is short. Days are short. These are my main objections. I cannot believe. I don't know if other people have that feeling that time flies so incredibly fast that you're constantly trying to catch up and you're constantly behind. Yep. You know, I want to do so many things, but suddenly, you know, these numbers pile up and suddenly you have this like number that represents your age and you're completely shocked, like, what is that? How can that be?
Yes.
Honestly, that's, you're right. Okay, so we share that.
Yes.
I mean, that's the bigger picture. But even in a day, like, how? I mean, I'm looking at the clock right now as I'm talking to you. How can that be? It's already night. I mean, I haven't really begun my day, and it's already gone. I mean, this is like one of the biggest frustrations, apart from all these like global, you know, fall into fascism and, you know, all that.
We're falling into fascism, and I didn't get everything done.
Right, yep. Right. I mean, but like, why is it 8 o'clock already? I mean, that's my main concern, you know.
Right.
There have been many a time where I said, "Yeah, universe, I need 2 more hours today and tomorrow, please. Thank you."
Oh my God! Yes. Why don't they do that? These powers, whoever they are. Give us more time. Oh, I don't know. Anyway, I guess it's about time, so-called time management, and I was never good at that, and I'm not good at, you know, organization and kind of sorting out things and being tidy and with anything, you know, especially my time. So... Yeah, it's like, you know, I don't know if you feel that way, but you feel like you're cheated out of time, right?
Yeah.
She's like, where did it go? Was that some kind of a con game that was played on you? I mean, you know, I don't know. Anyway, I guess some people are like that.
Yeah, I remember a quote, and I will be damned if I can remember where it's from, but it was like, a well-lived life is never tidy. And
that's nice.
And it you know, because life is messy. You learn things, you experience things, and those things are never neatly tied into a bow. And
yes,
so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, and really, you know, you realize that that is true. You know, that so many spiritual practices and so many religions tell you, you know, that it's not about the goal. It's about the path.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it will never be perfect. And maybe you'll never achieve, I'm putting it under quotation marks, achieve, you know, anything. And so what? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So
right.
What? You are, you know, it's the effort that makes us human, I think. Just the mm-hmm. effort, not the achievement. So that's why I hate that question. You know, did you succeed? I mean, success. I mean, what a word. What does it even mean? You know?
Right. And if you've succeeded, then what do you do with the rest of your life at that point, right?
Right. Yeah. Right. You actually success. Right. That's a good thought, actually. You know, at the moment when you achieve success, all under quotation marks, you have failed. Right? Because you've killed the journey, right?
Right.
You ended it. You know, it's some kind of ending. I don't know. Maybe we're just comforting ourselves. I don't know. I mean, as human beings, you know, I don't know. I don't know.
I try not to overthink that. I look to,
right.
You know, making my art, working my job, being the best husband, father, friend that
right.
I can be. And right. Let the rest attend to itself.
That is true. That is that is really the only option. I mean, other that's the only way we can survive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then you ask yourself, did I really try my best? Why did I waste 3 hours of my time today, you know, on reading the depressing papers or something? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yes. but maybe you couldn't at this particular moment in time. You had to waste these 3 hours, and maybe they were not wasted. Maybe they were used in some other way that you're unaware of.
Right.
And so on and so on. I see that in this combination we could talk for another 10 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
You are very, if I may say, you are very, very, very good partners for a conversation.
Thank you.
I enjoy it.
Thank you.
Well, we certainly enjoy talking with you. Before we let you go, I do want to pass on my wife adores Delenn and wanted to remind me that we, in our wedding vows, we borrowed an exchange between Delenn and Sheridan at their goodbye, but we used it as sort of a joining word. So just wanted to let you know that was, you know, the Babylon Vibe is important to my life in so many ways.
That's so beautiful. That's, you know, it brings a smile to my face. And thank you, and say thank you to your wife.
I will.
It's beautiful. Yes.
Yes. And thank you for spending some time with us today, reminiscing. It really was our pleasure and our honor.
Yes.
Thank you. You were wonderful too. All right.
Thank you.
Good luck, and yeah, maybe we'll meet again in some
yes.
way or another.
Okay. We will. Thank
cool.
you.
Okay.
Right.
Good night.
All right. Cool. Good night. Good night.
Wow, was that interview worth waiting 10 years for? I think so.
Absolutely. And I think we should let our listeners know that we were originally going to talk to Mira on Wednesday, and that fell through, and she apologized. And my feeling was, we waited 10 years for this. I'm okay with waiting a few more days.
And this is why this episode is going out surprise today, Friday. And hopefully everybody will wake up over the weekend and go, what?
Yes, exactly. But that was everything and then some that I had ever hoped it would be. And
oh,
we're
yeah.
so grateful that she took time out of her busy schedule of wasting 3 hours of her evening or whatever it was that we were talking about at the end there.
Yeah. And it just warms my heart that some of her best B5 memories involve Andreas. It's like he was the set's grandpa.
I think in a lot of ways he was the heart and soul of that show.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He is certainly missed, but it's wonderful that even at this point in time that those memories are still, you know, ever fresh.
And it, you know, it's a testament to the writing and the performances that they still resonate as deeply now, 25 years later, as they did the first time around.
Yes.
There are scenes, Sleeping in Light still makes me shed a tear every single time I see it.
Oh my God. That's a sob fest for me every time. It never fails to have impact.
Yeah. But hopefully,
and there's so many scenes I go back and watch, and there's so many scenes that still have that same amount of impact, whether it's something funny, whether it's something dramatic and moving, whether it's something that's sad.
It's the it's like I said during the interview, the one scene where she's working with Susan to, like, you know, help her get her hair under control, and Susan is resisting, she's declining, and then Delenn just holds up the brush and has this little child like, please help me, and you see Susan just go, oh, okay, fine. And that, there's so much funny in that. It's poignant, it's touching, and just the little child like, please, and Susan going, oh man. It's just delightful for me. And I laugh every time, every single time.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's great stuff. So speaking of other great stuff, since we talked about all that, some news for people who may or may not know. J. Michael Straczynski is releasing all his scripts for Babylon 5 in new editions directly through Amazon Printing. Look for Babylon 5, All My Words, by J. Michael Straczynski. These are not reprints of the volumes that B5 Books printed through Cafe Press. These are just the scripts.
Yep.
None of the additional material, none of the photos or commentary that JMS wrote for those books.
Yep.
But reading his post about on Facebook, what he said was that it's been 14 years since those books had been printed, and there's a new generation of Babylon 5 fans that are out there that didn't get a chance to buy those books, obviously. And so he wanted to give them the opportunity to get the scripts. And he felt that this was a good way to still keep the exclusive nature of those Cafe Press books, but still get the words out there to people who would want those.
Yeah, those books you can still track down if you are a good internet hunter. They're on Amazon, they're on eBay, they're on a few other sites for collectibles. They're not cheap.
No, they are not cheap. As I was going through Amazon looking for these, I came across people selling their books, and it was,
they are not cheap. I am glad I have my full set, including the rare volume 15.
I've got that as well, and I treasure it.
And he signed it to me.
Because you're amazing, Summer. That's all there is to it.
Actually, that was for the work I put in on the chronologies book. So, yes.
So, again, you're amazing.
Mm-hmm. If you look at the Green Chronologies book, my name should be in there somewhere, I think. On the time, I vetted some of the timeline stuff, and Captain Jacqueline, I put forth the suggestion. It's like, you know, I'm missing a couple of script books. I'll take those in payment. She said, done!
Yes.
So
that's it.
I got my set completed, and I contributed to the B5 Geekery All Is Well in the Universe.
Yes, that's
awesome. But yeah, I will have links on the website to all the 11 books. Yeah, the new set is 11 volumes because it's just the ones that he wrote. And they're not annotated. There's no, like you said, there's no footnotes. There's no explanations. There's no introductions. There's no photos. It's just the scripts for all the episodes he wrote, seasons 1 to seasons 5. I don't think it included the movies, did it? It's just the series.
I think just the series. I'm looking here on the site, and it doesn't even look like. Okay, well, they're not in order on the website here, but it, well, it's Sleeping in Light through the Lost Tales. So this is volume 11.
So that would
so
have
it
to
does have it has Sleeping in Light, Third Space, River of Souls, Legend of the Rangers, and the Lost Tales.
Hmm. Okay,
and
then.
And for what it's worth, now I know what I'm going to ask for Saturnalia. The Lost Tales script says here, this early script features an unfilmed segment focusing on Michael Garibaldi. So remember, that was the third story that was supposed to be in Lost Tales,
right?
Garibaldi Mars.
You know what? I may have to get Volume 11 because Lost Tales was not included in that original volume, were they?
No, I don't think Legend of the Rangers River, I don't think any of the movies were in there. And in fact, I'm going to go back, I don't know.
No, there was a separate book for the movies, I thought, but
I don't remember
Legend of the Rangers and Lost Tales, I don't think are in there. And I can't check because they're all in storage.
And everything's upstairs for me, so I don't know that I have those actually. So, anyways, that's beside the point.
Yeah, we will put this out.
It looks complete.
Yeah, it looks complete. And you know, if we're wrong, Gary or Jason will leave a voicemail to let us know. I'm pretty sure. Love you, Gary.
Somebody's got to keep us on the straight and narrow, as
yep.
it were.
Keep us on our toes. Fact checking the fact checkers, right?
Yes.
Exactly. Well, this, you know, like I said, I'll have a post with links to all the new editions that have gone up for sale. They only just went up for sale this week, so you should be able to get them at the original low price.
$30 a piece.
They're $29.95-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that's cheap compared to what you need to pay for the originals these days. And pick the ones that you like the best. Pick all of them. You know, fulfill your collector need as best you see fit. But these are worth having. If you enjoy watching the show, reading, having the script there to read along with, especially if you're interested in writing or writing for television or writing for movies, you can't go wrong with these.
Right. Exactly.
So look for details on the website. I hope you guys enjoyed our conversation with Mira. The website.
I know I did.
The website is BabylonPodcast.com. You can follow us on Twitter at Babylon Podcast. Yes, I am doing most of the tweeting, but you never know when Tim might sneak in there and, like, you know, throw a gauntlet at Gary or Edmund.
Expect me when you see me.
And this message is special for Norm and Char. Tim is interested in a Day of the Dead recap. I know you guys just recently did yours, but he still has a few things he wants to get off his chest. He still thinks he's right.
I know I'm right.
Gary and Edmund and myself have tried for years to get him to lighten up, to get him to expand the possibilities in his mind. But he's just, he's adamant that Morden and Lanier should never have been together. And
there's just some couples that don't belong together, right? Dick and Liz.
But they tried it four times.
Yeah, that should have told you something.
But why did they keep going
back?
It was
just Lanier and Morden for one short night, but that was more than anybody should. Anyways, okay. Anyway,
yeah, but the opportunity to have another discussion for Day of the Dead is out there if Norm and Char are available. And I think we should really dive into just focus on Morden and Lanier and mull over the possibilities of what we might have seen had we been able to get a Susan and Talia in the dead zone.
See, right. There were so many better pairs that we could have.
But Susan wasn't on the station.
Well, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
But that's what fan fiction's for, right?
Yes. I'm not.
I'm not looking at the Susan and Talia's fan fiction at all because those ladies deserve their privacy. I'm not indulging. Just like I would never indulge in the Marcus and Steven fan fiction that I know somebody wrote. Somebody had to go there. I'm not even going to entertain the Susan and Marcus fan fiction that was out there because Babylon 5 is perfect to me. The fan fiction I wrote was from Crusade. That's all I'm just saying. All the fan fiction I wrote in the Babylon 5 universe was focused on Crusade, and there were shenanigans going on in there, and it involved tassels and...
I don't remember that character on the show.
Let's just say I was inspired by the, shall we say, how to put this for a PG audience, how impressed Dr. Chambers and Matthew Gideon were at Mr. Eilerson's, shall we say, entertainment selections. So yes. I expanded on what might have been Max's other fetishes, and I rolled with it, and that's staying on my computers, never to be seen by the rest of the world. Deal with it. Just know it's out there, or just it's not out there. Just know it's been written. Anyway, if you want to leave your own voicemail message, the number is 602-635-6976. And if you want to send us an email, I knew there was one more I was forgetting, babylonpodcast@gmail.com. Send us a message. We are planning our Feedback-a-Palooza episode. It probably will be the capstone on this return from the rim. And... you got a couple more weeks, not much more time, just a couple. And I guess we will see you on our next trip through the gate, maybe, perhaps.
Definitely.